Good morning. 7 past the hour. It's Faith Radio. Dr. Ann Bradley is an economist and a vice president at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics in Washington, D.C., and she joins us this morning. Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm great, Bill. How are you?
Good. We just celebrated Labor Day this past weekend, which really is the final real weekend of the summer for most people. And that day was originally meant to recognize labor unions in the U.S. And I'm curious, I mentioned we got a big nurses strike going on here in Faith Radio's home state of Minnesota. Give us a historical perspective on how labor unions have impacted our understanding of work and industry, both, let's say, here in the U.S. and in other countries.
Sure. Labor unions are a part of American history. And we can see when we go back in time, in many cases, why they were started. And usually the reason that you see the formation of a labor union is to protect workers who believe that they have unequal bargaining power. And basically what that means is just think of a scenario where you live in a small town, maybe you're a steel worker, and there's only one company for which you can work. Especially think about this 75 or 100 years ago, where we didn't have telecommuting and we didn't have cars where we could just drive to the next town and find different employment opportunities. And so this is often why we would see labor unions forming. And it was to protect workers and their rights, particularly when there was only one employer in an area. And so that's what we mean when we say unequal bargaining power. And so what those employees do is they come together through a membership to which they pay dues, and they negotiate. And this kind of being a collective gives them power and leverage that they wouldn't have otherwise had. What we're seeing in the United States in particular is that over the past 100 years, in fact, labor union jobs are at their lowest that they've ever been. And there's some real reasons just economically why this could be a good thing. One is that we don't tend to see employees only face one job opportunity, especially with access to the internet, global trade that we know. You could be sitting at home and having a Skype call with somebody in Tokyo without ever having to even own a car. And so this kind of accessibility to the broad global market diminishes the need in some cases for labor unions. So in the United States and in other places, they're on the decline.
So obviously in the past they have been necessary because there have been abuses, and we've talked about this before. The free market system, while a good one, isn't perfect, and there are fallen people in every industry. And we even look back at the history of our nation, Great Britain, where there were some severe abuses and the employees were hurt, and there was a need for collective bargaining and for workers to stand up and say enough is enough. But it seems that in recent years, the labor unions have changed significantly, become much more political. My wife, interestingly enough, was a teacher in California, so she was required to be in the California Teachers Union. Mm-hmm. When she learned that a portion of her union dues were going to support political candidates with whom she did not agree, she was very concerned. Then there was, I guess, a law passed where she could withhold a portion of her dues that was going towards political activism. But in many states, that's not the case. What has happened to labor unions that have taken them from their original purpose to where they are today?
One of the things, exactly what you mentioned, your wife's experience here, is what we're seeing often, is that think about going from the power of one person to the power of, say, 300 people. When you amass 300 people together and you have a lot of voices, you have some people that, you know, kind of through voting rules make decisions on their behalf, you also have more resources. So when I pull together my dues with 300 or 1,000 or 10,000 people, I'm much more powerful than I could be on my own. And this is just the natural tendency of labor unions then to become more political. Well, why? We would say, why? It seems like the original purpose was just to say, hey, you know, these employers can't take advantage of employees. And that may have been, in many cases, the original reasons and legitimate reasons for them. But as you mentioned, what we're seeing is they're becoming more political because they're lobbying to protect their industries. And in this way, we can see labor unions start to deviate from their original purpose. Their purpose is not to prevent competition. Their purpose should be to protect people who are vulnerable to employers. And in the digital age, it's just much less likely. It's not to say that that would never happen, but you're much less likely as an employee to only have one option. And so labor unions use their dues to give political contributions. And what do they usually ask for? Well, they ask for protection. They ask for rules over competition and the way that people can work in their industries. And actually, what we're seeing is unemployment is the highest in the unionized sectors of the economy. And this is why, because when you lobby for protection, you get less productive. And so as believers, what we know is true is that we're supposed to do the best we possibly can each and every day with what God has given us. If a labor union helps us do that, great, because we're vulnerable or marginalized. But we're crossing the line. Actually, we're defeating the purpose of being productive when we use the labor union to protect ourselves from competition, because productivity is about always being better with fewer resources.
So how do things like union mandates and government regulations supporting unions affect the overall economy, Anne?
Well, one thing that we know, other than higher levels of unemployment in their own industries, what we also see is lower levels of productivity. And that kind of factors into the overall economy. You're going to see less. When I say productivity, again, what I mean there is that we want people to be more productive with both less time and fewer financial resources, because that's really what we mean when we say stewardship, because we have more left over, more time left over, more money left over to do other things. And so the more unionized and hyper-political unions become, we're seeing less productivity and less innovation. And actually, that, I would say, is bad stewardship. And that leads to more unemployment because there's less money to hire more people, to be innovative. But the other thing that we see is inflation. So really what labor unions are doing is they're making it more expensive for employers to retain employees. And if employers have to pay more per employee, somehow that money has to come from somewhere. And usually what we see is it's passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices.
Mm. Our guest, Dr. Anne Bradley, she's with the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics in Washington, D.C. We'll take a quick break. Be right back at Faith Radio. Welcome back. This is Faith Radio. Bill Meyer with Dr. Anne Bradley. She's an economist, an educator, and a vice president at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics in Washington, D.C. We've been talking about labor unions, and I mentioned the big strike, nurses strike, going on here in the Faith Radio state of Minnesota. We actually, my wife and I spoke to a nurse who went out on strike with thousands of other nurses just this week, and both sides seem to be really digging in their heels on this one, and we're not really sure how it will end up. And what is the Bible's perspective on how employers should treat employees and vice versa?
This is where we should start. So, such a great question. I think what we learn from Scripture is that both employers and employees have responsibilities to each other. And so we think about the laborers in the vineyard. The employer and the employee in this, kind of parable are voluntarily negotiating. They're coming together and they're agreeing. And some people are working for longer hours in the day than the other. But the point of the story is, don't worry about what the other person is making, but worry about what you committed to do and what the return is from that. So I think some of it is that we want what other people want. This is just part of sin. We want to have the bigger house, the bigger car, because our neighbor has it. We want our incomes to grow up, to go up. I don't think that wanting a higher income is necessarily sinful. We have to want it for the right reasons. And so the other issue is that employees are we talk about in the Old Testament, you know, kind of not moving the boundary stone and being just. And if you're making an agreement with an employee, you have to pay them what you promised them. You cannot take advantage of them. And so there's responsibilities on both sides of the aisle here. And I think that's where we can get lost sometimes in this debate, is that we tend to view corporations as very powerful and, you know, just kind of bad guys. And they, at all costs, you know, will take advantage of people. And I don't think that's any more true for a corporation than it is for a person, because at the end of the day, who are we talking about? We're talking about fallen human beings who are sinners. So we have responsibilities as employees. Employers have responsibilities to us to not treat us badly, to give us what they promised they would give us. But does my employer have a responsibility to make sure that I get to go to Tahiti on vacation every year? I mean, I'm being extreme, but of course not. We wouldn't say that unless, again, you know, somehow we contractually agreed to that first. So I think we tend to vilify corporations here, and sometimes that's right. But I think we have to say, in a relationship like this, there's a contract. There's a negotiation, and so both parties have responsibilities to each other. And as Christians, we need to look at what those responsibilities are, and each party needs to have integrity to keep their word and to work hard for the other party.
That's well said. By the way, I put in the Tahiti vacation request last week, but I have not heard back yet.
Good. I hope you get it.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, let's turn to a different topic. What about minimum wage laws? This has been in the news a lot, especially with the presidential campaign right now. Did they actually raise the standard of living for everyone, as some would claim, or do they end up having unintended consequences that really backfire in the long run?
The answer, unfortunately, is in the long run, they don't do what we want them to do. And so this is why just kind of some good basic economic literacy is really important as we approach these issues, because I think many people want to help the vulnerable and the marginalized. And the minimum wage is intended to apply to people who are lower skilled, have lower levels of experience and lower levels of education. So they're at the bottom of the income distribution, and we want to lift them up. Now, that is a good intention, and economics forces us to say, well, are the results good? And actually, just a little historical data here. The minimum wage was enacted in 1938, and the first minimum wage was 25 cents.
Oh, wow.
So it's very different from what we're talking about in today's terms. It's been raised 22 times since then. So we've raised it a lot. Economists at the time of the first minimum wage, which is that 25 cents, did a study to look at how employment changed. And they estimate that at the time, 30 to 50,000 people became unemployed because of the minimum wage. So again, we can't just look at our intentions in the policy space. We have to reconcile ourselves to the outcomes. And minimum wage tends to hurt the most vulnerable. I mean, that's actually the tragedy of it. It's that, you know, the CEO or the person who has a PhD or a master's degree and is doing computer engineering, they're largely unaffected by the minimum wage. But what we're talking about is the teenager who doesn't have a lot of experience, not a lot of education, not a lot of skills yet that are developed. Maybe this teenager lives in the inner city and needs to help his parents or single parent pay the rent. Do we really want to keep that person unemployed? And that's exactly what we do. And the people that are most affected by unemployment is our teenagers. And some teenagers really need the income to help their families. So again, we have to kind of look at the long-term effects of the minimum wage. I think it makes us feel good to say we can raise it, but it actually makes it hard for businesses in the same way unions do. It raises the cost of employment. And so we're going to, you know, employers have to find some other way to keep their business going. And usually what they do is cut hours, cut training, or just lay people off. In some cases in Seattle, what we've seen is entire businesses are closing. If the minimum wage is raised so significantly, it just businesses start closing. So that's really bad for the economy and for jobs.
And they often move somewhere where there's not that kind of a law or government restriction. But of course, that's getting harder and harder to find here in the U.S. Yeah, let me ask you this, Anne. There's been a popular buzzword in the culture recently, buzz phrase, I guess you could say, and that's income inequality. Explain what that phrase really means in the minds of many on the political left in this country and what they would like to do to solve that problem, as they see it.
Sure. I love this question. It's been on my heart for several years. So this issue of income inequality is tied to all the policy issues we've talked about already today. And it's this idea that, you know, it's hard. I think if we all sit down and reconcile ourselves with this question, it's hard to think that there are people that have four houses and can go to Tahiti, as we mentioned, anytime they want. And they have just so much. And then there's people who really struggle, and there's people who live on $20,000 a year. And, you know, if there's a hole in their tire, they actually don't know what to do. Maybe they have to get a second job, or, you know, they can't buy as many groceries that week. I mean, it's hard to live in a world where you see the super rich and people who are just scraping by or maybe not scraping by without any assistance. How do we solve that? So I think we need to come to this, as the left does, with the right levels of empathy. We want to help the people who are struggling. But the question is, does erasing the income gap do that? Now, minimum wage is an attempt to lessen, not erase, but lessen that income gap. But what we see with the minimum wage is that it actually hurts the very people we want to help. And here's what I would counter the proposals that I'm hearing to affect income inequality. Nobody is starving or dying because of income inequality. People are starving and dying because they're poor. And what we need to do is help the poor transition permanently out of poverty. What does that mean? It doesn't mean making Bill Gates less rich. It actually means enabling the poor to be able to sustain themselves on the God-given gifts. And so many people are poor not because they're not skilled and not because they're not talented and not because they don't have human creativity written on their hearts. They do. But they are trapped in a situation where, as I said before, these trade-offs, like, you know, I have a busted tire and now I can't take my kid to the doctor. Or, you know, if my kid is sick, I have to stay home and lose a day of pay. These are very hard trade-offs. We want to eliminate those. And we do that by helping people become more productive. And as Christians, I think that needs to be our guiding principle.
Mm. As always, just some great counsel for us and great wisdom. Thank you so much. And by the way, if you want to learn more about Ann's work and her organization, it's the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, IFWE, in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, Bill. So fun, as always.